Good evening, and welcome to Tuesday Topics. I'm Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida, your host for the evening. I'd like to begin by thanking Rachel for not only moderating but recording tonight's program. And I'd like to thank whoever gets involved in doing the editing of our chaos into an appropriate and effective ACB radio program. I'm not sure who that's going to be in ACB radio, since all sorts of folks have ended up doing some of the editing over the last little while. Please accept my appreciation, you guys, for all the work that you're doing. And of course, we'd like to thank George Byes from Talking Communities, who makes this software available to ACB Radio so that this program can happen. Tonight on Tuesday Topics, we're going to be talking about the role of local private agencies in providing services to people who are blind. And we are very fortunate to have someone who brings to the topic a good deal of experience. Originally from Portugal, Inicio Correa, grew up here in South Florida, where I am, or spent a fair amount of time here, but has since traveled all sorts of places. Most recently, he was assistant director of the rehab agency in the state of Maine, and is now in a similar position with the Atlanta Area Agency Serving the Blind. He has had some experience working in a rural state, as well as some experience now working in a very urban kind of environment that, by the same token, has some outlying counties that it tries to serve. He's just the kind of person to provide us with some perspective on the role that a local agency serving blind folks can play, and we're very pleased to have him with us this evening. To start with, Inicio, why don't you fill in some of the other gaps that I might have left out in your biography? What other stuff have you done, and perhaps what other places have you been involved in working, so that we can have a better idea of what your background is?
Well, Paul, thank you for inviting me to talk to the folks here. I actually grew up in Portugal. I went through, I am totally blind. I lost my vision when I was 3 years old. And I went through a school for the blind in Portugal for the first 5 years. Then I went to my regular school, local school in my hometown. And this was, I hate to admit it, but it was many, many years ago, to the point where I actually needed it. At that time, I needed to get a special authorization from the Ministry of Education in Portugal to attend my local high school, middle and high school. I then went on to college in Portugal, in Lisbon, and I actually finished my bachelor's degree in Germanic philology, which is, I guess, the language and customs and literature of English and German. And then I moved to the United States. And I moved to Miami. It was my first job was in Miami at the Miami Lighthouse teaching Braille. I then went on to pursue graduate work at the University of Arkansas in Little Rock as a rehabilitation teacher, or what's now called a visual rehabilitation therapist. And I decided then to do my internship in New York City, at the Center for Independent Living. It really was a really good move for me. I ended up staying in New York on and off and working there for the same agency for nearly 20 years. For those of you who may question whether or not why I moved so much, I just wanted to get that in, that I did stay in one agency for a long time. I had a chance to also work for a short period of time for Helen Keller International overseas, and I did some work in Latin America and the Caribbean in working with local organizations, nonprofits, and also local governments to improve or expand services for blind people in those countries. And I worked briefly in Philadelphia at the Associated Service for the Blind as their rehab director and then human services director. And more recently, I worked in Maine, as Paul said, at the IRIS Network, a private nonprofit, a statewide organization, and I was their VP of Program Services prior to coming to Atlanta, where I've been only about 2 months since January.
So you really do have a kind of a varied background, and one that that has given you an opportunity to look at a lot about how private agencies operate. And have also had an opportunity to work for an independent living center, which is interesting. So to begin with, then, tell us a little bit about what you think the advantages of having a local private agency in one's community might be, and what kinds of special, I guess the right word is special, skills and aptitudes a local private agency might have in service delivery as perhaps compared with a state agency.
Well, I think probably the biggest advantage is the fact that a private nonprofit agency typically, by its own nature, I think, has a little bit more flexibility, perhaps a little bit less bureaucracy, a little bit less of a rigid process that a state agency, by its own nature, often may have or may need to have. Private agency may be more likely to be able to be innovative, to be creative, to take some risks. Having said that, and I must say here that I've in all my I guess almost 30 years work history in this field, it has been always with a private agency, which is kind of interesting. I never worked with it for a state agency. However, because I have had a chance to work in different states, I really have gotten a very good. I've become very aware of how different state agencies work, and I think in many ways, as I said, the private agency can be a little bit more creative. But certainly, because we often are so dependent financially from the state for support, we often also depend on state or some of the leaders in the state agency's ability to allow for that creativity and that flexibility. But again, I think that the state agency does offer a great deal of more flexibility and also an ability to establish a closer partnership, I think, with the consumers that we serve. And maybe we can talk a little bit more about that in later on in the program.
I think you're essentially correct. And I think we're probably, and perhaps you'd agree with this, I think we're probably now moving to a place where less and less of the rehabilitative training services certainly for older people, are being delivered by state agencies, and more of it is being delivered for older people and perhaps for babies and children as well by private agencies. There still is, I think, this huge segment in the middle, that is the rehabilitative training segment, where I think the division of labor is less clear, since there are a lot of state residential rehab centers. And maybe it would be good to talk for a moment about the role that a residential rehab center can play, and whether you believe that residential rehab centers and local private agencies complement each other or are at odds with each other.
Well, it's interesting that of all the places I've worked, from Florida to New York State, Pennsylvania, Maine, and now in Georgia, the only place where I really came in contact with a residential rehab center, state-run, was in Florida many, many years ago, back in the 70s when I was living there, and I actually attended that center. I'm familiar with other rehab centers, but residential centers, but none of the states where I have worked, in fact, have one. Georgia is now beginning a discussion about opening up or establishing a residential rehab center, which I believe they had a few years ago, and for some reason, one reason or another, it didn't work out. And there's some discussion now about revisiting that idea. In other places where I have worked, more recently Maine, anytime there was a need for a residential rehab experience, clients were being sent to either Little Rock, the World Alliance Center, or Louisiana, or I believe maybe Colorado. You know, some of those residential centers. But we can perhaps discuss now the advantages and disadvantages. I have very strong ideas about that, but you know that's my experience thus far.
Well, in fact, according to a number of recent authorities, and in particular the philosophies that are espoused by national centers operated in Louisiana and Colorado, The services delivered by local private agencies are inappropriate and inadequate, don't provide appropriate rehabilitation, and according to these centers, the only way to provide appropriate rehabilitation for a person who's losing his or her vision is not only to send that person to a residential facility, but to send that person to a residential facility for a long time, typically 6 to 9 months, and to have some very specific approaches that are taken while that individual is there. And in particular, there are two cardinal issues. One is what might be described as philosophical indoctrination into right thinking about blindness. And the second component is that everyone, no matter what their visual acuity is required to use occluders and operate as though they are totally blind. Are they right? Are in fact private agencies incompetent to rehabilitate blind people, and is the only way through a long-term visit to national centers?
No, I don't think they are right. And if they were, that would mean that only a very small percentage of blind people would have advantage to be rehabilitated, quote unquote, because they are covering a very small number of people, of all the people that we work with. When I first moved, and this may be interesting for folks, when I first moved to Maine, 7 years ago, or almost 7 years ago, to work, we did have, the agency that I was working at had a residential rehab center, and we had to close it because of lack of referrals. People were often not willing to leave their families, move down to the so-called big city in Portland, Maine. So we had to close it because I couldn't keep the staff occupied. So I think to say that someone, the only way that they're going to be rehabilitated is to go away for 6 to 9 months is to deny a choice, first of all, freedom of choice of what program they want to get involved with, but also to deny a whole set of experiences that the person has, regardless of whether they got it when they were blind or sighted before joining the rehab program. And I think that is one of the fallacies of that philosophy. I think more and more of the people we're working with in the rehab field are people who are low vision and often have a great deal of vision. And to deny them again the use of that vision, I think it just doesn't serve any purpose whatsoever, in my opinion. So I do think that in some cases a residential experience is a good one, especially for people that live in a rural setting and don't have a chance to socialize or to come in contact with other blind people. I think that a comprehensive program that takes place on a daily basis, on a commuting basis, if you will, can do just as well for many people.
So let's focus a little bit on local private agencies. I think it would be accurate to say that most of them right now have more work than they can do. They are operating often with waiting lists in terms of people who need their services. To generalize again, I think most local private agencies are operating with 16 to 20 week programs of study, and after 16 or 20 weeks, it's expected that the folks who are being served by that agency will move on and will have completed their work there. Now, you know, please feel free to disagree with this. But where I'm coming from is, first, to contrast with the other system, but second, to begin to ask a couple of I think, tough questions about local private agencies. If local private agencies are in fact operating with waiting lists, as I think many of them are, Is the 16-20 week stuff an appropriate solution, or are there problems with that?
That's an excellent question. I think you're correct. There are many agencies, private agencies, have waiting lists. I think the 16 to 20 weeks on average, I guess maybe it is probably still a good barometer, a good number. Are there problems with it? I don't think so. I think that, to me, the biggest problem is the fact that funders often and by funders I mean here the state agency, is looking at what we do in the private agency when we offer what I call pre-vocational services. More and more state agencies are looking at those as training or job readiness kinds of activities, and they're not. You know, someone may come out of a 15, 16, 20-week training program, be wonderful with mobility, they have good computer skills, they may have excellent ADL, daily living skills, etc. They can live independently, all that, but they may not be ready to get a job. They may still need some job-related skills that were not part of that program or some specific training program for a particular job. I'm finding now that more and more state agencies are looking at our programs, rehabilitation programs, as job training programs, and they're not. You know, they can have a component of a job training, but I think especially agencies that are not specialized or separate agencies for the blind are looking at us as any other typical job training program, albeit Goodwill or Easter Shields or whatever, that once the person comes out of there, they're ready to be placed and all that. And I don't think I certainly don't proclaim that that's what we do.
Do you think that there's now more pressure on private agencies to serve rehab clients, that is, people who are eligible for voc rehab dollars, people who are typically then between the ages of, let's say, 18 and 64 and who are looking at going to jobs, rather than older people or kids who don't qualify for vocational dollar?
Well, I mean, there are, where I work now at Center for the Visually Impaired in Atlanta, we actually are very comprehensive. We're pretty much, we serve people, everybody from, as we typically say, from cradle to death. We have a children's program. We have a very clearly defined vocational rehabilitation program for people from the ages of, say, 18 to 64, or that may be increasing depending on the age of people going back to work. And then we have an older blind persons program that is funded totally separate from Title VII and Chapter II funds for older blind funds. So in that sense, we are very, you know, we have very three segmented types of population. I think what I was saying though before is that even though we rehab per se, and by that I mean the traditional skills, O&M skills, daily living skills training, and now the computer and other communication skills training, while it's well accepted, when you're talking about the elderly, when you're talking about younger adults or adults, the working age adults, the expectation is that those essential blindness skills, for lack of a better term, have been more and more seen as work-related skills. And I don't believe they are. I do believe, however, though, that we need, as a field, need to begin to revisit the idea of developing specific training programs for specific jobs. And this is something that every time I mention it, I tend to get a whole lot of negative feedback because we often think about stereotypes of piano tuners, medical transcriptionists, cell phone operators, etc. of old. However, I think if we can find now current types of jobs and professions that we can train people for, then obviously it's still a question of choice, and they have the choice to take those or not. But certainly it's better than, you know, being unemployed, which is what over 70% of people are.
Let's talk a little bit about outcomes and how we measure them. One of the issues that's certainly out there for local private agencies in particular is that while training is supposed to happen and while people are there for a certain length of time, because of the pressures of a waiting list and for a variety of reasons, people don't tend to stay longer in major programs than, say, 16 or 18 weeks. And once those folks finish the program or have completed their training, I guess there are a few questions. First, are we doing a good job of of developing follow-up systems so that we can continue to ensure that those folks are involved in the community or involved in other ways. And second, are we doing a good job of measuring, say, a year out or 2 years out, the degree to which the skills that we've taught blind people are in fact retained by them and continue to be used by them?
No, I don't think we are doing a good job with either one of those. One of the challenges that I've started to tackle here in Atlanta, and it's not a unique problem by no means, is to, as a private agency, I want to demonstrate to the state that funds our services that our success in learning these basic rehab skills will ultimately be a predictor for a successful outcome in employment, in placement. Now, we don't do any placement at this moment at the Center for the Visually Impaired, none of the private or community rehab providers here in Georgia do. The state claims that they do that. So one of the things that I'm going to try to do is to track those people that go through rehab with us and somehow maintain contact with them so we know when they become employed, so I can use I can derive some statistics that indicate, that hopefully prove my point, maybe they won't, that in fact people that go through rehab are more likely to be employable. The other point that you made in terms of utilization of skills, we agencies typically do a 3 and perhaps at the most 6 months kind of follow-up with clients to identify whether or not they are still using their skills, do they need any additional training. But after that, we typically don't do it. And we don't do it probably for many reasons. One being that we may be afraid in many ways that people will say, yes, I could use some more training, because then what do we do with that information? And two, just because of the volume of numbers that we're talking about. Now, I know for a fact that in all the private organizations I've worked with, we are always very careful in telling people that they are always welcome to call us back should something change, if they need some refresher, they need some additional assistance. If their situation changes, it could be one of the spouses dies or becomes less able to perform some of the daily living skills, or if they lose more vision or whatever it may be. But I don't know how many of those people do in fact call us back. So we probably could do a better job, but then again, the question is, what do you do with those responses if we already have a waiting list for current clients?
I guess the other question that arises for me from the whole issue of the absence of follow-up is, are there things that we could be doing in the community that might in fact assure that the skills actually remained? One of the things that bothers me, to take an example, is that there really isn't an appropriate partnership between private agencies at the local community level and consumer organizations, whether it be NFB or ACB. There's not nearly as good a job, I think, of connecting people who are in these facilities with organizations like ACB or NFB so that they continue to remain involved with blind folks. And one of the things that I've noticed here is that the longer a person is away from rehabilitation, the more impacted they are by a family's willingness to do everything for them, and the less prepared they are to go on using the skills that they've learned. And somehow I think if our training's going to mean anything, we really have to, I think, develop some approaches that will involve people in the community. You know, I think another whole issue that you might want to talk about is the degree to which area agencies on aging, for example, are really not doing a good job of integrating people who are blind into their programs, and perhaps we as private agencies aren't doing a very good job in terms of holding their feet to the fire and saying to them, our folks who are blind are old folks too, and they have just as much right to your programs as others do.
Yes, you're correct on both ends, and I'm hesitating because so much of what you're bringing up, Paul, are things that have resurfaced here in the last few days in discussions with my staff and others. I do think that we private agencies can work can establish a closer relationship with consumer organizations. I think the easiest types of collaboration already happen, whether that may be, you know, be attending state chapter conferences or meetings and other local meetings, participating in legislative action between that is sponsored by the consumer organizations or supported by them. I think I've seen that in many states where I've worked. You're correct. What it doesn't often happen is a closer relationship or closer connection between the consumer organization and the blind person as they go through rehab. And I'm very interested in that. And I'm certainly, once we open up for discussion, I'm hoping that I'll be able to get a lot of good ideas from the folks here in the room, about that, how to accomplish that. I know there's a huge need for people for some type of involvement once their program is over. I just had a discussion with some folks last week here in Atlanta that former graduates of programs, they've gone through the private agency, received a rehab, and either they are now looking for work, or in most cases they're older and they're not interested in work anymore, and they are wanting to have a ongoing connection with a private organization in terms of recreational program, just socialization, etc. And I, as much as I understand that need and applaud that wanting to be to continue that connection with other blind people, frankly, I don't know how to do that. How to disconnect or transition from a educational rehabilitation type of training program that has a beginning and an end, and then on to a more supportive, ongoing type of intervention, whether it's recreation, socialization, etc. I do agree with you. There's a need for us to do a better job with local organizations and agencies on aging, although I must say, I've done a lot of work with those in other states, particularly in New York, and I don't know that the answer is as clear as I once thought it was. Even after a lot of the work and people showing a great deal of receptiveness for people who are blind and visually impaired and people with disabilities, you also still find a lot of people that are older that are blind and visually impaired that are saying that, you know, I'd rather be in a place where I don't have to prove myself. I don't have to have that challenge of ongoing or that ongoing daily challenge of dealing with whether it's sighted folks or just a challenge of being blind or whatever. I hope that I'll be able to impart some information here, but also get a lot of ideas from other folks.
I have two other issues that I want to talk about. The first one has to do with curriculum. Do you think that private agencies have done a good job of altering their curriculum to take account of where we are, for example, with computers? Maybe I'll just leave the question that way and see what your response is.
Absolutely not. And I include myself in that equation, of course. I think we are finally beginning to realize that times have changed. But it's not just the private agency. It's also we depend in many ways on the professionals that come out of rehab programs from colleges and universities, that they themselves are still teaching communications as they did years ago, or perhaps any computer related types of courses tend to happen in a whole week, 1 week time frame, where everything is students are exposed to pretty much everything. I think it's changing a lot, and I think it's changing primarily, I think, if I can take some credit for it, because of blind professionals that are in the field, and they themselves are pushing the envelope a little bit. And perhaps we can, before the end of the program, talk a little bit about the role of blind professionals in this field, which I think is critical. So in other words, I don't think we've done as good a job as we could. I think we are trying to catch up finally.
It's my observation, and it's only that. I don't really have statistical data necessarily to back up my contention. But it would be my observation that the number of blind people who are going into the field of rehabilitation these days, and in fact probably over the last 20 years, is substantially declining, so that there are in fact fewer and fewer blind professionals in the rehab field. First, do you agree with this? Second, any ideas why it might be happening? And third, is that a good thing?
If I can start with, I'll go backwards and start with the third one, since that's what I remember most. I think that is not a good thing. That is a very bad thing. And I think you're correct. Probably the number is decreasing. And I think probably the reason is the fact that more and more of the programs offered by private agencies are itinerant and rural-based, where people go to the client's own homes and teach daily living skills. And I think the more rural those become, the harder it is for, obviously, for a blind person to provide that function, or at least it becomes more expensive for the agency because it requires some assistance with transportation. I know where I worked in Maine, a lot of my staff, well, not a lot, but some of my staff were blind themselves, and we provided a driver reader to everybody. But, you know, not everybody can afford that, and I don't know how long they'll be able to afford that themselves. I think what you've seen now, though, which is interesting, is that with the fact that university programs are now accepting people who are low vision for into their mobility programs, I've seen at least an apparent, and I have no numbers, but it seems to me there might be a possibility that number may be increasing again of people who are low vision in the mobility field. But again, I don't have any numbers. So I think hopefully I answered your 3 points.
I think you did. The last two issues that I want to cover before we open this thing up are first, evaluation of services, and dare I use the word accreditation. Are we doing a good job of evaluating the kind of service delivery that we offer? And I guess connected to that is accreditation through an organization like, say, the National Accreditation Council, an appropriate thing for rehab agencies to be doing? And if you think it is, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about why.
I think it is. I have been fortunate, I guess, to have worked with several organizations that were NEC accredited. I've also had I've had an opportunity to be involved in the review of several organizations that were going through their own accreditation process as a member of a review team. I've done probably, I would think by now, 10 to 15, maybe 12 different reviews of different organizations, which is a wonderful, I mean, for me, it's a wonderful experience because you get to learn a lot of what other people are doing and take from them what works and try to avoid what you see doesn't work with them. I think it's a good process, and I think it's primarily good because it's the only one we've got. If there are problems with it, and I don't claim to say that they're not. I think there are problems that are not inherent to the process. There are problems that might be able to, that could be fixed or tweaked. But I think the process is a good one. It allows an organization to measure themselves against the same standards that others or other similar organizations providing similar services are measuring themselves against it. And I think that's always a good thing when you have that those kinds of norms that you can compare yourself to. You know, again, that's the only process we have, the only one I know of. And can it be improved? Yes. Is it a good process? I think so. I think it's an invaluable process. In fact, if I can go on and say, and actually, the Center for the Visually Impaired where I'm working now is actually, we're undergoing our reaccreditation process this year in 2006. And probably the most important part of that process, the whole accreditation process, is actually the self-study, the time, the few months that all staff, board and constituents and consumer organizations and all types of stakeholders actually take part openly of that in the process of analyzing what we're doing, what is working, what's not working, what needs to be changed. And if we go into that process with an honest and open mind, approach, I think it can be an invaluable phase of this accreditation process.
Last issue, governance. There are kind of two schools of thought that are out there about the governance of local private agencies. One school of thought says that the boards of private agencies need to be strongly influenced and dominated by people who are potentially good at fundraising, and that a core value of any private agency's ability to continue delivering services is its ability to raise enough money to continue to operate. On the other hand, there are those who would argue, and certainly your Independent Living Center is a good example of this, that consumers have a right to have a stake in the way that a local agency is operated, and therefore it's absolutely crucial that a substantial voice of consumers is heard on boards of private agencies. My question to you then is given this kind of push and pull, are agencies doing a good job on both sides of that issue? And perhaps if they're not, what do you think ought to happen to kind of improve things?
Let me just clarify something about the Center for Independent Living that I worked with in New York for many years. Despite the name, was not part of the Independent Living Center movement. So it was a 501c3 separate, private organization, and we had a board of directors similar to what most of other private facilities have. I think that it is useful, and not only useful but critical for organizations to have a good representation of their constituency on their board of directors and their various governing bodies. Having said that, I think it is essential that that boards of directors have the expertise within their mix that private organizations require. And you mentioned fundraising, that's certainly a big one, but also all types of other expertise, whether it's public relations, marketing, financial management, legal. The field of nonprofit nowadays is so complex. The rules we need to maintain and to follow as far as financial management and accountability, all types of reporting processes we need to implement for all types of funding sources, whether it's the state, United Way, foundations. I mean, it requires such a high level of expertise that is very different than when I first joined the field 30 years ago. That I think the boards and the various governing bodies of these of the private organizations need to represent and include those various expertise. Having said that, can we do a better job in working with local organizations, consumer organizations? Yes. Do I believe that they should have a controlling voice in the governing bodies of the private organizations? No, I don't. I don't believe that.
I guess I'd just ask one more question about governance, and that is, while I certainly understand that consumer organizations or consumers in general don't need to have a controlling voice, I think there are a lot of us who would argue that many private agencies handpick the blind people that they put on their boards of directors in order to be pretty sure that the folks who are going to end up on their boards are not going to be very critical of the work that they do. Maybe they do that with other board members as well, but it seems to me that it's particularly egregious when you can say, well, gosh, I've given constituents a voice, but in fact you really haven't. And I wonder if you have any ideas about what we might do to make that whole situation better, and also whether you think that, in fact, I'm correct.
Well, I think you're probably correct, but I think I'm glad that you added, Paul, that, we do that with every board member. Obviously, I don't know that purposefully an organization is going to pick or encourage someone to join the board of directors that they perceive to is going to be negative to begin with. So there is a certain level of selection going on. I also think, though, that there's got to be other venues where consumer organizations can and should have to voice their opinion and to maintain, in fact, by being outside the governing body, they'll be able to maintain a certain neutrality and impartiality that will give them a lot more credence, I think, to speak. The challenge, though, is for the organization to establish or to foster those forums where consumer groups will have an opportunity to voice their opinion, whether it's in needs assessment types of forums, whether it's in discussion groups, whether it's in members of advisory committees, whether it's in coalition types of groups, which I'm a big believer in. So I think there should be those kinds of opportunities. And perhaps even in terms of, as we hinted at before, bringing in consumer organizations into the rehab process or program so that newly blind people can gain a better understanding of what's available in terms of the consumer movement and helping bridge the gap between the time when they are involved in the rehab program and then the time when they leave, and they are on their own.
I think we've gotten a pretty clear picture of at least some of the issues that are out there for private agencies who are providing services at the local level. And perhaps it is now appropriate to see what other people think and to see what questions others might have for Inicio about this particular topic. So, ladies and gentlemen, remember to tell us who you are and where you're from. The floor is open. Go with the first question.
Paul, if I could add one more thing just before we open it up. I think one of the challenges that I see that all of us need to pay attention to and perhaps become involved with is I'm a big believer, strong believer in the need for specialized services, not only in terms of professionals perhaps that we use, but also primarily in terms of the way state agencies are organized. I've been fortunate in every state that I've worked until now. I worked in a state where there existed a separate agency for the blind, whether they were called commission or they were called division or whatever, and whether they were within labor or within human services or child and family services, it really almost didn't matter. What mattered, though, was that they were separate. They had their own budget and their own specialized counselors. I am now in a state that it's not where that is not the case. Services for the blind are provided by the VR agency that provides services to everybody else. Now, I understand that a few years ago, out of a compromise, they established what they called specialized caseloads, where special counselors that serve blind and visually impaired people are sort of specialized, or at least they focused on their population more so. But the people that they report to are generalists, and I think that can ultimately create a problem because I think in my experience, services for the blind or the types of rehab services we provide tend to be more expensive than other disabilities, primarily because the other disabilities already got a bulk of their services provided in the hospital setting, so they didn't, or the medical setting, so they didn't come out of VR.
Yeah, I actually think that the point you make is an extremely valuable one. And Georgia is an extreme, but it's by no means the only state where there is not the degree of specialized service delivery that exists in other states where there are separate state agencies. And I think in Georgia in particular, we're actually probably now moving back in some more appropriate directions, whereas when the separate service delivery model went away in Georgia, there was pure chaos. And in fact, for 4 or 5 years, there was virtually no appropriate or specialized services that were being delivered in Georgia for people who are blind. Okay, open to questions.
Hi, Inicio. This is Chris in Maine here. I have a question, and I wanted to ask, in where you live now, Inicio, Georgia, there's you said that there's problems with people with these rehab services, and why they sometimes don't provide them. I'm just wondering, why is that? Oh, and I just thought of another question, too. How is this going to improve the services down the road in that area and fix the problem so that eventually down the road it's not going to be an ongoing type of problem?
I think, you know, the only way to address problems or inadequacies or whatever is with communication. And one of the things I really believe in is establishing a very honest dialogue between the private and the public sector. And and I'm not afraid of getting consumer groups involved in that dialogue, which I think, you know, I certainly need them. And they, you know, we are part of the same process. So I think with dialogue and ongoing education, and then also using the clients, the recipients of services, they are the best ambassadors to the service that we provide.
Hello, this is Gary Wood, and as far as, you know, specialization goes, I think when I in the 60s, early 60s, services of mine was under social services, but I don't think it was as much specialization there as it was later. Now, Michigan has a commission for the blind that came up in the late 70s and early 80s that became a commission, and to me it sounds better that way. And of course, I went to the Rehab Center for the Blind in Kalamazoo, which is state-run. I think that one thing you mentioned about providing services for people, like they said, that there's a beginning and an end point, but suggestion, I think that maybe there's something to be said for an idea of lifelong learning, because no matter what, I mean, there's always something that you can learn from any experience, you know, no matter how old you are, how young.
Gary, I agree with you. I think the challenge is for us in this kind of work with blind and visually impaired people is, where do you draw the line? Where do you say that, okay, this person got all these essential skills, basic skills to go out there and kind of, you know, be more independent, and then and perhaps be able to continue their lifelong learning in the same mainstream environments where everybody else. Where do you draw the line, or do you continue, or are there certain services that you want to continue providing to those folks on an ongoing basis, or is there, perhaps more importantly, is there a need for the private agency to be the vehicle that helps those people to connect with other blind people, and whether it's by providing socialization opportunities, recreation, etc. That's really what I'm struggling with right now.
We talked earlier a little bit about follow up and about what people should do, and I know this is a quandary for private agencies, but have you found some models for follow up services a year or 2 years out that are being used by some agencies that seem to offer some reasonable compromises? Because I guess I'm concerned that one of the things that we hear in consumer organizations from folks who have gone through particularly local agencies, and I guess this is probably more true of older people than it is of younger ones, that they really do want to maintain some kind of connection. They want to keep active. They want to continue to get together with the friends that they've made. They want to be constantly reinforced in terms of their belief in themselves and their capacity to believe in the independence of blind folks, and are very frustrated over the fact that they can't. So have you found any models that appear to offer some approaches that may alleviate these issues?
Gosh, I wish I had. I haven't. And I tell you, you touched on all the things you just said are things that we, as a staff, I've been engaged in these discussions with former clients of where I work right now at the Center for the Visually Impaired. They say exactly the same things you just said. And I am going to start a dialogue with staff and clients to try to come up with some answers. You know, but I have not seen any models really that I can depend on, and granted, I have not done an exhaustive research on this, but I don't think that they exist. I think most private agencies struggle with that. Obviously, one of the major issues is that there's no funding for that. You know, the state agency that funds most of our programs wants a beginning and an end, and they're not willing to provide ongoing types of interventions like that. The first challenge is going to be to identify funding sources. But I am convinced that there are, not only there are some funding sources out there, but also there are things that perhaps, activities that once we provide the space, that perhaps either through volunteers, peer group leaders, etc., that some of that programming can be offered that way. That's my hope, and that's what I'm leaning towards.
Yeah, this is Gary Wooding, and I'd mentioned about going to a rehab center that was a state-run facility, but I remember we had a discussion one night about these centers, and I think that where I went was more regimented than a private agency might be, but some people may not like that kind of thing. I think Paul mentioned about the national centers, like the one that somebody mentioned about the NFB-run centers, and there's a lot more strict, and I don't know that, if I had gone to one of those, I don't think I would have liked that as well, but I think that's probably, maybe it's a personal preference thing or something like that, but I guess that's quite the gamut as far as the extremes.
Gary, let me tell you that I didn't think of mentioning this when Paul asked me the question. I think one of the biggest differences between the NFB philosophy as far as residential centers and what other private agencies do, or our field of vision rehabilitation services or blind rehab services in general, is I think the biggest difference is that is a question of expectations. I think as a field, we have watered down our expectations. We have lowered our expectations of what we expect blind people to come out of the programs. And I, for one, believe that one of the reasons is, well, perhaps several reasons. One is the fact of the whole issue of consumer choice that RSA and has probably with good intentions has put out there, that has led to many programs giving blind people the choice of what classes they take, what things they learn, how they learn, how long they learn, etc. And often we expect people to make those decisions with very little background, and people that they are already afraid of that they are not going to be able to succeed anyway, so why should they have great expectations for themselves? So that's one reason. I think the other reason is probably related to the fact that there are less blind people involved, not only in providing services in the private sector, but perhaps more importantly, involved as vocational rehabilitation counselors. I really believe that. All the successful models I've seen in the past, and I go back years now, were from people that were themselves blind and were not afraid in being very forceful and upfront with blind people. And I don't think we do that anymore.
You've talked a little bit about the front end of service delivery, and we really haven't talked very much about this. The model seems to be that you take people into your center and you deliver a range of services to those people that are pretty circumscribed. You've already determined that everybody needs orientation, mobility, and everybody needs home management, and everybody needs computer training, and everybody needs communications training. And so you have this really cool curriculum worked out, and once the students have reached the point in that curriculum where they've mastered the specific components that the agency has valued, their time at the agency's done. But is this the right way to deliver services at the front end? And if it isn't, what might we do differently?
Well, I mean, that's probably an effective way to provide services to someone who's newly blinded or never received services before. I think where we perhaps could do a better job is for people that need to come back for specific training, and that's becoming more and more of an issue in the technology area. You know, someone that needs to come back because their job now is using, they move from Lotus Notes to Microsoft Excel, for example, or Microsoft Access, and they need some specialized intensive training on that. I think it's taken us, and by us, I mean I'm using it broadly, it's taken us a while to adapt to that, because that person's not going to be fitting in that mold that you just mentioned before, Paul. So, and often we'll have to be a one-on-one kind of training, with specific resources, and I don't know that we have done as good a job on that, addressing those individual needs as we could have in the past. Also keep in mind, though, that private agencies are often limited by the type of contracts and agreements they have with the state agency. For example, a good example is the computer technology. I'm a firm believer that everybody who's blind or visually impaired, for that matter, could benefit from learning how to use a computer, whether it's with enlargement software or with speech. However, in some states, in many states, that type of service is not supported by the state unless it is vocationally related or the person is vocationally oriented. And we all know that, I mean, the fastest growing segment of new computer users are older folks. And I'm sure blind and visually impaired people should not be any different.
Is there a final question or comment for Anicio from the group that's gathered here?
Well, I think that probably one of the things that probably needs to be taken note of is that maybe I think it's going to be important for the blind, like you mentioned, that I think that all blind people could benefit from learning how to use a computer, which I think is true myself, but I think that in the coming years, I think that any skill that a person has, I think that's going to be related in some way to learning how to use a computer, no matter what kind of work it's going to be. I think there's going to be involvement with computers in all our lives, if not already.
I still see state agencies having absolutely no problem in spending lots and lots of resources in teaching people how to do all other types of communication, learning communication techniques, which is a good thing, whether it's Braille or large print usage or whatever. But somehow when it comes to a computer, they think, that's not communication, that's not that's employment. And I think that's a fallacy, because obviously it's a major communications tool that can increase someone's independence, whether it's through, you know, by enabling them to shop, do their financial management with online kinds of stuff, banking, keeping track of phone numbers and addresses, calendars, etc. So, well, I don't have to convince you guys, but that is a need to constantly educate the potential funding sources for that.
Anicio, thanks very much for being here this evening. I think before I sign off, is there a final thought that perhaps we haven't had an opportunity to cover that you'd like to pass on to us, or is there another issue that I haven't been smart enough to raise with you that you think you'd like to throw out on the table?
The only thing I guess I would throw out is the fact that I am interested in continuing and expanding and increasing the dialogue with consumer organizations and anybody else for that matter that has any ideas of how to solve some of the issues or address some of the challenges that we touched on here this evening. So if anyone has any ideas after this talk, feel free to contact me. I'd love to talk to you individually, as a group, at any time. So I really encourage you to give me a call at the Center for the Visually Impaired in Atlanta, and you can find the number anywhere, but my number is 404-602-4301. But if you look for CVI, it's www.cviatlanta.org.
I think we've learned an awful lot tonight about the role that private agencies play in delivering service to blind people who are blind or visually impaired in this country. And while I think we've established that they're doing an excellent job in many respects dealing with a population that's much too large and with resources that are far too meager, I think we've also established that there are a lot of areas where collaboration between consumers and local private agencies can have a tremendous impact on improving services. Thank you very much, Anicio, for being here this evening. Thank you to all of our listeners who tuned in this evening. Next week on Tuesday Topics, we'll take a look at the provision of information to people who are blind through audio. Traditionally, that's been done by radio reading services, but Newsline, operated by the NFB, talking reader services operated in several states throughout the country and the internet are becoming increasingly common ways of providing information to people who are blind. What is the state of the game in all of these areas, and what can we expect of audio information delivery to people who are blind in the future? Join us next week on Tuesday Topics when we explore the exciting topic of how we'll get information and what kind of information we'll get on ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community.